The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Good morning, Philadelphia and South Jersey. Welcome to Inside Medicine. I have lined up an excellent program. We have a doctor on board today, Dr. Michael Barnish, who's been in the business for 39 years. He makes sure that people can travel the world with proper vaccinations so they don't get sick. Additionally, Mike will be helping us out with other items such as bone infections, which require expert care. He's got 39 years of medical experience. He's well boarded, an excellent guy, good communicator, and he'll be with us in a minute. I just want to open up. It's Olympic time. And there was two quotes from Olympic individuals. This is from Mark Spitz on winning. The difference between mediocrity and stardom is only 4 to 5%. So if you're close, just don't give up. Keep the nose to the grindstone and make sure you get done and go where you want to go. Another patient, another athlete, Simone Biles, Olympics gymnastics champion, quote, on passion. If I thought of gymnastics as a job, it would put too much stress on me. At the end of the day, if I can say I had fun, it was a good day. How does that apply to everybody in their work line? Do we all get enjoyment from our work, or is the work just pounding us down? So let's try and do a little bit of Biles. I do want to point out that the GLP-1 drugs were in the news again. There was a publication on tobacco use disorder. And interestingly, semaglutide, a glucagon-like peptide agonist, has shown that it improved the discontinuation of cigarette smoking. This is an initial foray, but will tobacco use disorder benefit from GLP-1s? Those medications are just revolutionizing medicine, and that's why they're still very hard to get. But let me introduce my guest, Dr. Mike Barnish. I've worked with Mike for a number of years. Mike is one of the best guys for vaccine insight and for world tours. He's a guy who makes sure that when you go internationally, you come back in great shape. Additionally, he works in the local hospitals for Rowan and Virtua, and he's the guy who takes care of people with osteomyelitis when bones get infected. That requires exquisite skill to make sure the patients get better quickly, because the average patient is going to get IV antibiotics for about 6 weeks to get better. So Mike takes care of the toughest cases, very important to Rowan and Virtua. And Mike, it's a pleasure to have you on again.
Thanks, Joe. Thanks for the great introduction. Thanks for having me on your show again. It's always a pleasure. It's interesting you brought up the Olympics comments, and I will be talking about COVID today, but Noah Lyles, the Olympic runner who won an upset gold in the 100 meters last week, had COVID and was diagnosed 2 days before his 200-meter run. And the day of his run yesterday, he had 102-degree fever and won the bronze. If I didn't know what determination was, certainly he demonstrated that. So it's interesting how the two conditions come together in strange ways.
Well, I would say he was lucky I wasn't taking care of him, because I would have said he's not capable of running and it'd be ridiculous. And maybe that's why he ended up on the turf. But you got to give that guy, he's got heart. So a good thing he didn't see me, Mike, and he should. And as long as he saw you, he'd be okay. So you want to? We have had an issue with the recrudescence of long COVID, and you're an expert on this. And we need some insight, because I've had one patient with 102 temperature. They had me guide, put every kind of defect, in front of me so that I wouldn't get sick from the patient. He survived, did well. So can you tell us about long COVID, which appears to be back? What the heck is it, and is it dangerous?
Well, I mean, just as confusing as the condition itself is how it's defined. Even the formal name has gone through several iterations. It's generally accepted as long COVID. That's probably the simplest way to define it. But it's been described as post-acute COVID-19, long-haul COVID, long-term effects of COVID, and chronic COVID. So all kinds of definitions for the same condition. In fact, Anthony Fauci originally proposed naming it post-acute coronavirus disease syndrome, or PACS. And it's such an unwieldy and clumsy name, it really never took hold except in the formal medical community. And the actual definition of long COVID is just as murky. It seems to have become, unfortunately, an umbrella term for a whole host of syndromes. In fact, the number of people who get long COVID after infection has ranged anywhere from 2 to 75%, which is really a wide range. And the reason for that is because it has differing definitions. So we've gone through defining it so many different ways that it's unclear who actually gets it. For example, previous definitions used 4 weeks after infection, if you still were sick after 4 weeks of having COVID, you were considered having long COVID, or 3 months or 6 months, and it's been all over the place. So recently, the National Academies of Sciences came up with a definition that most medical societies now recognize, and that's basically that long COVID is an infection-associated chronic condition that occurs after SARS-CoV-2 infection and is present for at least 3 months. So if you have COVID and it's still 3 months, that's still considered acute. If it's still there 3 months after infection, now it's considered long COVID. And it can manifest as either being continuous, which means the symptoms are there every day, all day long. It could be relapsing or remitting, which means symptoms come and go, or progressive disease, where it gets worse and it affects one or more organ systems. So that's basically how we define long COVID.
So what are the symptoms that someone has if they're diagnosed with long COVID?
So unfortunately, there are no blood tests to confirm the disease. It is a clinical diagnosis, which means we diagnose it based on signs and symptoms, physical exam, and complaints from the patient. And unfortunately, the symptoms are pretty wide-ranging. Long COVID can make pre-existing health conditions worse, or it could be brand new symptoms that the person never had before they had COVID. And the symptoms can be mild or they can be severe. Most common symptoms people get are post-exertional malaise, where if they do any kind of activity, they feel really poorly. They have fatigue, difficulty concentrating. A lot of times this is called brain fog in lay terms. Memory changes, recurrent headaches, lightheadedness. And some people may get palpitations or a rapid heart rate. It could disturb sleep patterns. You can get shortness of breath or a cough. You can get problems with taste or smell, bloating, constipation, or diarrhea. So those are the kind of like the global nonspecific symptoms that we associate with long COVID. But there's also some diagnosable conditions, irregular heart rate, blood clots, migraine headaches, stroke, certain mood disorders. There's a condition that's getting a lot of attention now called POTS, which is postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. This is when people change their position or posture. They can have low blood pressure or increased heart rate. In fact, Katie Ledecky, who's an Olympic swimmer, just came out the other day and said she's had this for years. Hyperlipidemia or high cholesterol, diabetes, interstitial lung disease, fibromyalgia, and these symptoms can be continuous or they can come and go. So you can understand the confusion with long COVID because it covers such a wide range of things. And a lot of these are nonspecific, but what ties it to COVID is that they follow an acute infection.
So Mike, that's got so many different possibilities. Is it easy to diagnose somebody with long COVID with this multiple manifestations?
Well, basically, the only thing we go by is a person says, I was fine, then I had COVID, and ever since COVID, I've had X, Y, and Z symptoms. And that's basically what we're dealing with now to make the diagnosis.
So when a long COVID patient comes in, is it easy for you to make the diagnosis, or is it hard because of the myriad of symptoms that someone could have? Is there something that makes it easy to make long COVID diagnose, or do people just simply say, I read in the book that I have symptoms of long COVID and I got it? How do you dissuade some patients from saying they have it?
I mean, the first thing I do is try to see if there's something else causing it. And the reason for that is because if it is due to long COVID, we're really limited in how we can treat it. So my goal is try to find something that's treatable. So if they come in with certain conditions and they say it's long COVID, but it's like a stroke or a blood clot, well, then I'm looking for some specific hypercoagulable state or a neurologic condition that could be attributing it, and maybe the COVID diagnosis was coincidental. So the key is always to find if the symptoms can be related to a specific disease that can be treated. If you really can't do that, then you unfortunately kind of have to take their word for it that this all developed following a COVID infection. And in my experience, most patients are pretty honest about this. I mean, they're not looking for an excuse to be out of work or something like that, and they're clearly distressed when I see them. So, you know, they are genuine in their concerns and the fact that this never was there before COVID. They're not saying they have long COVID, but they're saying, you know, I've been fine until I had COVID. So it's almost like a diagnosis of exclusion in many events, in many respects.
So when people come to the doctor, they're used to, you know, getting a prescription when they leave. Is there any prescription that you can give to this presentation that's got a myriad of symptoms? Anything that you can give them to walk out, say, got a prescription, go to the pharmacy and get fixed? Or is it tougher than that?
Well, you target the symptoms. So basically, if their main symptoms are shortness of breath, you address that condition. We don't have any specific medications for brain fog or concentration issues. But of course, if there may be an issue of blood clots or stroke, you definitely want to rule that out, whether that be with CAT scans or other certain blood tests to do that. If they're short of breath, a lot of times we refer them to cardiac or pulmonary rehab specialists, much like we do with other chronic diseases where those symptoms predominate. So there's no quick fix with respect to a medication that you can give them, but basically you target whatever their symptoms are and whatever interventions are available to help with those symptoms until the condition resolves.
So it sounds like you're doing a very big differential diagnosis, coming up with the best diagnosis you can that meets this patient's symptoms, and trying to give them some hope of getting better. Is there much hope of getting better from long COVID?
Well, from what we understand, we don't know how long it lasts. It does vary from person to person. Generally, it can resolve over a period of months, or it can persist for months or years. We don't know how long, in the worst cases, how long it'll last, because the disease has only been around for 4 years. So we don't know how long it will last. But on average, it does resolve over a period of months. It's not clear what demographic group is predicted to have a shorter or longer period of infirmity. So we don't know who is at risk of getting long COVID that responds less well than others. We don't know that. All we know is some people get long COVID, and we can't predict based on their underlying medical problems how long that long COVID will last and when it'll resolve.
Okay. So, Mike, you got a tough job explaining all that to a patient because there's not solid answers. Like if you have pneumonia and it's a bacterial one, I got the right RX for the bacterial one. So are you seeing an increase in people with long COVID? Because I know we've had a few acute cases lately come to the office.
Fortunately, it's been decreasing. There was a recent panel survey found about 5% of U.S. adults have had post-COVID. So, and that's down significantly from when the disease first came out. But that still is about 17 million people as of October of 2023 who have been diagnosed with long COVID. And that's basically the population of New York City. That rate has decreased since 2022, but it's kind of leveled off around 2023. In early 2022, the rate was 7.5% among unvaccinated adults and 3.5% among vaccinated adults. So basically, there's twice the risk of getting long COVID in those who have never been vaccinated versus those who have been vaccinated. When we look at children, it's felt that about 1.5% of children get long COVID, so it's a small amount, fortunately. And it was a recent study in the United Kingdom that found that the risk for getting long COVID after a second acute infection is half the rate after a first infection. So if you don't get long COVID after a first infection and you get another infection of COVID, you have less, even half a risk of getting long COVID. So overall, it looks like the rate is going down, but there still represents a significant number of people who have it.
So Mike, has anybody or any group or any university come up with an answer as to what the cause is of COVID? I mean, is it something you can draw a tube of blood and make a diagnosis?
Well, the cause isn't still clear. It is suspected to be an autoimmune response where the body overreacts to a foreign invader, like a virus, and exaggerates the response to it. And there's a lot of autoimmune diseases where the body attacks itself more so than a normal response. So we still feel that some people have a hyperreactive response, which causes it. There's also suspicion that there may be persistent virus that doesn't clear. And some of the conditions like the brain fog may be due to microclots or organ damage. And we do know that the virus that causes COVID, SARS-CoV-2, does disrupt the blood-brain barrier. And the blood-brain barrier is a membrane between the bloodstream and the spinal fluid, so that things that are normally in our blood, like antibodies and other proteins and certain types of viruses, bacteria, don't get into the spinal fluid. But we do know that when there's disruption of that barrier or inflammation, some things can spill over into the spinal fluid and cause a lot of these neurologic effects. And we do know that potentially SARS can do that. And we feel that might be contributing to brain fog, theoretically. According to the CDC, long COVID represents a lot of potentially overlapping entities, likely with different biological causes and different sets of risk factors and outcomes. So that kind of further confuses the issue. So we're not sure about the cause of long COVID, but we think it's where the body's immune system is our own worst enemy.
Got it. So my question is, do you think that there would be a way of, I mean, that ability of that virus to penetrate the blood-brain barrier is actually incredibly a fearful item on my list, because you want to make sure that bacteria, even though how small they are, don't get into the brain, because that can change people's personality, et cetera, I would assume. So is there any tip-off of any work going done to figure out how this virus gets across the blood-brain barrier?
Yeah, there is information that suggests that it does. And in many cases, just like COVID can present many different ways. A lot of people get shortness of breath, cough, pneumonia. Other people may get diarrhea or GI problems. Other people may get neurologic conditions such as stroke. And we do know that the people with neurologic conditions are the ones where the virus can get past the blood-brain barrier. We just don't know why yet some people who get infected with COVID, that happens, and in others it doesn't. So they're still working on that.
Okay. Well, that you opened my eyes a bit there. I just didn't know that that blood-brain barrier issue, which certainly makes that virus a fearful item for years to come, unless we can correct that blood-brain barrier leak. So can you define what exactly, I mean, you kind of already intimated, but what is there a specific, this is how we officially diagnose long COVID, or is that still in transition?
So there are criteria, and basically, like I said, it's 3 months. So if you've had COVID for less than 3 months, it's still acute disease. Once it's past 3 months, now it's considered long COVID. And this can follow a COVID infection that had no symptoms or mild symptoms or severe. So the degree of severity someone gets from their COVID infection has no prediction as to whether they're going to have long COVID or not. Previous infections may have been recognized or unrecognized, and long COVID can continue through the symptoms. So if someone has acute COVID infection and they're sick, it can continue onward past the 3 months. Or you can have someone who's actually recovered from COVID and totally became without any symptoms, and then all of a sudden they develop a recurrence of those symptoms or even new symptoms even after the infection is resolved. And again, that's more confusing because I've had patients where they had COVID, they got over it, and then maybe a month or two later they develop similar symptoms or shortness of breath out of nowhere, and we can't find a diagnosis, and the only link we had was, well, they had COVID a couple months ago. So it doesn't necessarily represent a continuum of symptoms right through the acute infection, but actually the infection can go away, and then the symptoms pop up a little bit later. So again, a lot of the criteria and definition of long COVID is based on timing of the disease and symptoms thereafter.
So, Mike, you definitely have this down because it's actually hard to characterize it. So can you give a typical time frame for how long COVID lasts, or when you can make a diagnosis of long COVID for a patient to try and help them understand, you know, what their symptoms are from?
I think on average, long COVID is about 4 to 6 months. That's been the average. There's worse cases or better cases, but I think most people, if they haven't resolved their symptoms after about 6 months following infection, at least they're getting better. And I think that's the good news, that most people over time will get better and it'll go away. I think there are very few cases that have been in existence where the symptoms are still there from day one from people who were infected in 2020 or 2021. So that's the kind of hope that I give to patients, that over time it will get better and will go away. That's what we're seeing. On average, it could be, for those who have long COVID, could be half a year or so, but their condition can be improved with the cardiac and the pulmonary rehabilitation to help them manage their daily lives until the disease resolves.
So is there any other disease entity that would be like this viral COVID deal? Like, how about something like people who get syphilis and it penetrates the brain and causes symptoms 30 years later? Or sometimes we can make a diagnosis of syphilis that was it's 30 years old. Is there any other invasive agent that's like this COVID virus?
Absolutely. And the best example is Lyme disease, where there's been a lot of misunderstanding about Lyme and chronic Lyme. I guess this is the best example. We do know that there's a certain duration of time where antibiotics work for Lyme disease. Yet there are a number of people who continue to have symptoms related to their Lyme. That's been redefined from chronic Lyme disease, which suggests that the infection is still there, to something called post-treatment Lyme disease, which is the chronic form. And the emphasis there of post-treatment means that antibiotics will no longer play a beneficial role in taking care of these patients. And it's been a very frustrating condition because the blood tests, once they're positive, they don't tend to go to negative. It just shows that you've had the disease in the past. And there's been a big debate among physicians and groups that come up about how to treat Lyme disease, whether they should be on antibiotics indefinitely or not. And we feel that this post-treatment Lyme disease is exactly the same with long COVID. In fact, I found it very beneficial to explain to my patients with post-treatment Lyme disease that it's similar to long COVID, because a lot of people know and have heard about long COVID, and when they now realize that that Lyme disease can cause the same thing, it makes it easier to understand. The cause is still not clear. We're looking into risk factors as to why some people get prolonged Lyme symptoms and others don't, and we're trying to link that to COVID as well. But those two diseases, I think, are the best ones to compare. Certainly syphilis is one to a lesser extent, but Lyme is the one that's going to be getting the most attention.
So is there a way, we're just jumping a little bit around here. So if someone has Lyme's, is there a change in what the recommendations have been to how long to take antibiotics or what antibiotics to give so that no one gets long Lyme's?
The best approach is early diagnosis, because the sooner it's diagnosed and the quicker it's treated, the less likely there will be complications where the infection is entrenched or the immune system continues to think it's there long after it was treated, because the antibiotics treat it relatively easily. But again, the immune system is the body's worst enemy, because the immune system, for some reason, can still think the infection is there. And that's why some people continue to have symptoms and others don't. And as a reflection of that, we see that with people on long-term antibiotics, they're not getting better because it's not the antibiotic that they need. It's correction of the immune system. And unfortunately, we're in a position where we don't have a medication or a direct treatment to reset the immune system back to normal. That's something that over time seems to correct itself, but again, is very, very frustrating. When we try to look at risk factors as to who gets these conditions, not that well known in Lyme, but we do know that in COVID, there are certain people who are more likely to get long COVID. And that's basically people who have underlying hypertension or chronic lung disease, obesity, diabetes, and depression, especially depression, interestingly enough. And we've seen that in kids who get long COVID. Children and adolescents on antidepressants, if they get COVID, for some reason, there's a higher rate of them getting long COVID. So I don't want to downplay the depression aspect. Adults with emphysema or chronic bronchitis actually reported the highest rates of long COVID. Also, females, for some reason, are more likely than males to get long COVID. It's about 8% versus 5%. And interestingly, midlife adults are more at risk of getting long COVID. Younger people tend to be healthier and not at risk of getting long COVID. And older adults, elderly ones, are more likely to have been vaccinated, had more boosters, and had lower rates of COVID infection overall, again, probably because of their vaccination status. So the people in the middle, the ones ranging from, say, 35 to 50, they're the ones who tend to get long COVID. And for reasons we don't quite understand, Hispanics and white adults had higher rates than blacks or Asians. We do know that the Asians seem to have the lowest rates, and they also have the highest rate of booster shots. So, and then there was one recent study in JAMA Psychiatry found that people with not only depression, but anxiety, worry, perceived stress, or loneliness had a 1.5 rate increased risk of getting long COVID.
So can we just bounce off the COVID line for a second? Because you talked about Lyme. So, can you just give the audience like a quick view of what are the symptoms of Lyme, who gets it, and how do you recommend treatment, and is there a timing for the treatment is better? Sorry to deviate here, but I just want to see what you've got in that brain.
So the deer tick carries the parasite that transmits Lyme. It's actually a coiled bacteria. And tick has to be attached for at least 48 hours because it takes that long to cement itself in, inject an anesthetic so you don't feel it, and then it starts feeding. So if the tick has been on you for less than 48 hours, that particular tick will not infect you. But if it's been on for more than 48 hours and it's engorged, there is a risk of spreading the disease. The disease usually occurs within probably 7 days or so, and people can develop a bullseye-type rash that is completely without symptoms. No itching, no burning, no pain. So a lot of times people may not know they have a rash, especially if it's on their back or on their scalp. And then the rash may disappear with or without treatment. And some people get fever, like I said, muscle aches, joint aches, fatigue. And if that is recognized and treated in a timely basis within a couple of weeks, the response rate is close to 100% of successful treatment. The blood test may not be positive for about 6 weeks. That's how long it takes for the antibodies to develop. So if you have someone with a tick bite and a rash and they present for medical treatment and someone does a blood test, just because it's negative doesn't mean they don't have Lyme, because it might be too soon for that test to be positive. So that's why anybody with a history of tick bite and rash, we go ahead and treat as if it's Lyme, and we don't necessarily count on the blood test helping us out. Now, once the symptoms have been there for weeks to months, and about 10% of Lyme patients may get eye issues or heart issues like heart block or neurologic issues like Bell's palsy, that's considered disseminated disease or disease that spreads through the body. And that doesn't mean it's necessarily harder to treat, but symptoms might be a little bit more severe. The problem is the patients who don't realize they were bitten by a tick and they have these symptoms that last for months and it wasn't really diagnosed, and by the time it's diagnosed, they're treated with antibiotics. But the body has been fighting it for so long that even if the antibiotics clear the infection, the body still thinks it's there. So that's why timing is so important, with between the time a condition is diagnosed and when it's treated.
So just let me ask you one item here. So when someone sees you in the office and you all of a sudden get the idea maybe it's some long history here, do you ever recommend a spinal tap for some of those people? Does a spinal tap give you more information than a blood draw?
Well, 9 out of 10 people won't go for a spinal tap. So even if it's suggested, I have very few people, I could probably count on one hand, that were willing to have that done. If the symptoms are neurologic, in other words, outright weakness or paralysis of a limb, those are considered hard neurologic signs, then a spinal tap may be helpful. And those cases are important because if the spinal tap has the antibody in it, the blood's going to have the antibody in it. So if someone's on antibiotics and they don't get better, but I still think there's a neurologic component, then I would recommend a spinal tap. Because if I'm going to commit them to 4 to 6 weeks of IV antibiotics, it's really nice to make the diagnosis. I have to emphasize, however, that symptoms like brain fog, confusion, memory problems are not hard neurologic symptoms. They're soft, which means they're subjective. You don't really find them on physical exam. Those people generally don't have neurologic Lyme disease, or certainly not Lyme disease that will be corrected with IV antibiotics. So I kind of discourage spinal taps in that situation, because that's more often, I've yet to see someone who is positive with those soft neurologic signs. So
Mike, I just want to tell you, I had this one case years ago. The patient was a long-term patient, probably for 30 years. The wife complained that he just wasn't himself. He just wasn't picking things up, wasn't problem solving like he did. And so I put him in the hospital, and the neurologist came in, and we told the neurologist that he's not himself. The neurologist said, look, I don't think it justifies doing a spinal tap. And I basically insisted because the guy was not himself. He did a spinal tap. It came out positive for Lyme's. But I know he got started with IV treatment intravenously. But, you know, my impression is it's pretty hard to pick up somebody with CNS Lyme's. Have you seen any of that, such as, you know, your doctor has to know you so that he knows that you got to push a little further, because who wants a spinal tap? I agree with you.
Well, I don't want to say that I haven't pursued that and haven't done it. So certainly cases like that are significant enough that it's certainly warranted. And obviously when they're in the hospital, they're more of a captive audience. It's easier to do a spinal tap. And clearly those signs warranted, because if he's not himself, I'm sure there were some specific conditions that may have reflected dementia or profound memory loss that would make the diagnosis concern greater. But in many of the cases where they just have some mild confusion and it's relatively short term, it might be premature. Sometimes if I really think it's there and they don't want the spinal tap and their insurance will cover it, I will treat them with IV antibiotics. Most cases of Lyme, however, can be treated with oral antibiotics if the spinal fluid is not involved, including arthritis of the knee or other weight-bearing joints.
Fantastic. So, is there any other issues that you wanted to pursue? Because I'm endocrine and you know more about this topic than I do. Anything else that we should know?
Regarding, if we go back to long COVID, I think what people would be most interested in is how to go about treating it. And like I said, there are healthcare providers who have historically specialized in cardiac and pulmonary rehab, and they are now managing long COVID patients. There are hospital systems and other independent institutions that have actually created long COVID centers to treat these patients. I know that Virtua locally has a long COVID center. And again, we approach them much like we would with other people with chronic heart and lung conditions. There are actually clinical trials ongoing. There's one called the RECOVER, all in caps, RECOVER, RECOVER clinical trials across the country that are enrolling patients for cognitive retraining or brain fog. So they are looking into specific retraining efforts to get their memory back. Sleep therapy is another form of clinical trial. And they're actually looking into using IV immune globulin or ivabradine, for a possible treatment to speed up the resolution of COVID. So they're actually being done. We've looked at Paxlovid, which, as most people know, we use in moderate to severe cases of COVID. We know it works there. Unfortunately, recent studies have shown that Paxlovid is pretty much ineffective in treating long COVID, but we're still looking at the studies to see if it does play a role. Metformin is a medication still being investigated for long COVID, and it's a diabetic medication, as you well know, that actually has benefited in other medical conditions, and now it looks like COVID might be a promising option for its use. Some patients have benefited from supplements like N-acetylcysteine, clonfenacin, vitamins B, C, and D, alpha-lipoic acid. These are all supplements that may help in some people. There's really minimal risk in trying them, so it can't hurt. But there's ongoing studies to see if maybe some vitamin or other supplements can help, if not speed up the resolution of long COVID, at least make the symptoms less severe.
Wow, things are getting complex, huh?
Yeah. There's also... go ahead.
No, I'm just amazed at how much you guys have to do on the differential diagnosis and get to the testing that gets done. And I mean, I know that the doctors at the NIH who have a family history of dementia all basically are not, I should say all, from what I understand, just about all are taking metformin to try and make sure that they ward off dementia. So it's interesting to hear now comes metformin, you know, one of the drugs that I use forever. It's been on the market a long time. It works real well. And here it comes down, you know, for a CNS issue and another focus with infection. So I'll give you some samples if you need it, okay?
It's great. Yeah, it's like that and statins tend to be the magic bullets now to treat more than just what they were originally targeted to.
Mike, did you ever know you were going to get into this business?
Of
it seems
COVID
like you're handling a lot of things.
Well, I've learned
the whole
over
infectious
the years
disease.
It's something I always wanted to do, but I've learned over the years that it is one of the few specialties where something will come out of nowhere. And after a period of panic and chaos and uncertainty, we try to figure out how to approach it. But that's just part of the specialty, where we have to anticipate that there'll be new viral pathogens or bacteria organisms that will mutate or develop de novo or out of nowhere, that we have to use our past experience with in trying to address. There are consequences to long COVID that I just wanted to touch upon as well from a public health standpoint. And, I mean, we know that it translates to millions of dollars lost in productivity and days lost from work. But there's also a potential issue. It can have a dramatic impact on our economy with respect to benefits paid out in Social Security disability. And because the condition is so poorly defined, claimants can potentially seek Social Security benefits, and this could put a tremendous strain on the viability of our Social Security program. So we really need to make – it's really incumbent upon us to more clearly define long COVID and know how to treat it, because not only from a public health standpoint, but from an economic standpoint, this can be a very difficult disease.
So I wanted to just move on a second, because, you know, you take care of a lot of very sick people. I'm just talking about, what about people who get bone infections? How do you have to treat that? Because I think sometimes they need aggressive antibiotics for a long time. How about patients? Do they come to you with these bone infections? I'm sure you see them in the hospital.
Yeah, people who get bone infections, it's usually from breaks in the skin that allow bacteria to get in and over time affect bone. And why bone infections are so difficult is because they're not well vascularized, which means blood supply doesn't get to bone as easily as it does to skin or soft tissue. So an infection can take hold in bone, and our own natural defenses that create white blood cells and macrophages and other host defenses that can get down to an area of infection and fight it off, you need the blood supply for those proteins and white cells to travel. And blood supply to bone is limited, especially in people who are diabetic or who have vascular disease from smoking or just poor circulation, and those are the ones that have problems with bone infections. And unfortunately, treating them requires IV antibiotics, because you don't get enough pills to get into the blood supply, enough concentration of drug. So oftentimes they're committed to long-term IV antibiotics. We really haven't had a good definition of a bone infection since 1970, and unfortunately, it's been a one-size-fits-all approach where we give 6 weeks of IV antibiotics, but that's not the case with all infections. A lot of times, surgical debridement, where you clean out the infected bone, is very important and may play more of an important role than antibiotics. We don't always have to commit to 6 weeks. Sometimes we can start with IV and then switch over to pills when it gets better. Sometimes we have to optimize the blood flow. Otherwise, we're wasting our time with antibiotics. So there's a lot of complications with bone infections, but they tend to be especially difficult in people with poor circulation, especially diabetics.
So you're saying that sometimes you have to pull in a vascular doctor to come in and increase the blood flow, say if it's a foot infection. They have to really get revascularized with the antibiotics to make sure that the patient gets better and the bone gets cleared.
Right. Otherwise, you can continue to give antibiotics and it's a futile exercise because it's not getting to where it needs to get done. So it is a collaborative effort between infectious disease and surgery, podiatry, depending on where the infection is, all of them. And like I said, in many cases, the surgical resection or clearing is just as important as the antibiotics and the improving of the circulation.
Fantastic. And so how long does a patient generally have to be treated if they have a bone infection? How long do they have to get that antibiotic to make sure that the bacteria is cleared?
It depends on the level of circulation viability, how good, how poorly compromised or how well their circulation is can dictate the duration. So I think the key point is it's no longer 6 weeks for everyone. If someone has better circulation, they may not have to be treated as long. If there's an area of dead bone that provides like a source for the bacteria to grow and you remove that surgically by cleaning it out, then the antibiotic may just clean up what's left and you may only need like 10 to 14 days of antibiotics. So it kind of depends on how poor or how good the circulation is, how far from the heart the infection is. Unfortunately, with the feet, it's the furthest away, so the blood supply gets less as it gets further away from the heart. So location is important as well, and how well you can clean that up and get the blood supply intact. So it varies based on all those factors.
So I was always very interested because I had a patient who had a diabetic with a foot infection, and the vascular surgeon came by. He since actually has retired, and he said, "Look, Dr. Fallon, if you have a foot infection, you also have to go up and check the circulation of the carotid." And I'm like, "We're talking about a foot infection, and you're telling me to make sure I get a carotid ultrasound." And lo and behold, the patient had carotid obstruction too, that just wasn't symptomatic yet, but was close to that 40%. So I'm just curious, how often do you have to go to the carotids, because that was a lesson that I learned years ago?
It's something that we routinely don't do, but it gives you a good window into circulatory issues. A lot of the ultrasounds that we do of the legs at this point, we call them ABI or perfusion measures, can be sufficient. So way back then, the carotids were a good marker, but I think we have better techniques, better radiologic tests that we don't have to do that. We can get more of a direct idea from doing the circulation tests of the legs.
Gotcha. Now, what about valvular disease? Because you guys get called in for those cases that someone can have a bacteria or a fungus on their heart valves. Is that easy to fix or not?
It depends on the degree of valve disease. Some people have what's called a bicuspid valve or two cusps of a valve versus three. IV drug users can continue to seed a valve and it can get an abscess on it. There's certain people with calcifications or congenital or birth issues where it makes the valve more at risk. So if you have a smooth, well-functioning valve, you're less likely for bacteria to seed that valve, as opposed if there's some pathology associated with that valve, and it's more likely the bacteria to get hold of it as to whether it attaches. Sometimes the valve becomes so poor, and you can relate this to any mechanical issue. If a valve is faulty or leaky or doesn't work, a lot of times it has to be replaced. So it kind of depends on whether you can restore the function of the valve by clearing the bacteria with antibiotics, or if it's so bad that you have to give antibiotics plus replace the valve. It depends on the functional integrity that you are dealing with.
Somebody has a valve infection. How long do they have to be treated generally?
Typically, with those, it ranges from 2 to 6 weeks. If it's an IV drug user with a staph infection and it involves a valve on the right side of the heart that goes to the lungs, a lot of times we can give two drugs for 2 weeks and that's it. And one of the reasons for that is IV drug users tend not to stick around in the hospital, and they sign out against medical advice. And they've done studies that show that 2 weeks is often adequate. Unfortunately, that population tends to go back and continue to inject drugs and get reinfected. But we do know that with certain bacteria, whether it be staph or strep, or enterococcus, the organism itself can dictate how long you have to treat, whether it's anywhere from 2 to 6 weeks, based on the organism you find and how bad the valve is.
So, Michael, you are one of the experts in making sure that people get vaccinated before they travel the world. Can you talk to the audience about your vaccine business? Because you're very important in that.
The one point I would suggest is that if someone goes overseas and they're going to a developing country, which is basically a country where the water is not safe, so you're talking about many parts of Africa, South America, Asia, you should look into whether there are any diseases that are vaccine preventable before you go. And you don't want to do that necessarily a week before you leave, because some vaccines may take 10 to 14 days to kick in and develop antibodies. So the one key takeaway is that if you are going to a developing country, look into that or ask your doctor, or obviously come in to see me. A lot of clinics.
I say see Michael Barnett.
Yeah, I mean, and I get a lot of calls about people who go to different countries, and I'll tell them whether they need something or not. But word has to get out to the general population, and ideally primary care physicians need to recognize that if they don't know what they need, they should at least know to refer under certain circumstances to travel clinics such as mine.
Yeah, but everybody doesn't carry the vaccine. So if somebody calls you up and says, I'm taking a plane out in 3 days, you know, you have a load of vaccines in the office, but most people don't. So how would someone get in touch with you for a vaccine assessment because I'm traveling across the ocean?
So we have a travel hotline actually for that. And the number is 856-325-3989. And that is a direct number to our travel clinic, where our nurse will pick up the phone, get all the information. And if we have someone who's leaving in a couple of days, we can more often than not get them in that day or the next day and give them what they need.
So that's really a Michael Barnett plus, I got to say that. And not too many places east or west of the Delaware River have the vaccines in stock like you do. Isn't that correct?
Well, yellow fever is probably the most important vaccine because many countries require it for entry, and not anyone can get that vaccine. You have to be considered a yellow fever designated distribution center, and that is determined by a state department of health. So only certain organizations have that designation and are able to supply the yellow fever vaccine, and I'm certainly one of them.
You are loaded with vaccines. That's why I can say that, Michael. And the people in South Jersey appreciate it, and Philadelphia. Do you want to make any summary comments? How does someone get in touch with Michael Barnett for vaccines or infectious disease? Because we're coming down to the end of the program.
So the general office number is 856-566-7070. And for people traveling, the travel hotline is 856-325-3989.
All right. Well, Michael, fantastic. How about any further comments? We got about a minute less that you want to basically tell people where you practice or give any final ID information that we need to know.
So I'm located at the Rowan Virtua School of Osteopathic Medicine, and that is in Stratford. And I also have satellite offices in Sewell and Turnersville, and try to be as accessible as possible, so people can come in on relatively short notice.
Michael, thank you for being on Inside Medicine, another great program that you've provided. And I'll see you at work on Monday, but Inside Medicine appreciates it. His podcast will be up in about 20 minutes. Thank you very much, Michael, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you. My pleasure.